Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
A lot of the stuff that we got to do in that movie has already come to fruition. The smart mirror, you know, there's plenty of mirrors now for the health and fitness market and other applications. Same thing with the smart table that he was using. You know, the holograms, I've seen a lot of different companies attempt to do some holographic stuff. Of course, nothing quite looks the same as Jarvis. But just, you know, I'm talking to you through these AirPods and I'm thinking about the Avengers when they all have like something in their ear that they're communicating with each other on. The age-old story of science fiction inspiring science fact, you know, that used to be so true with books, you know, inspiring inventors, whether it was 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, by Jules Verne, inspiring, you know, the submarine, and H.G. Wells, War of the Worlds, inspiring the inventor of the rocket ship, you know, now is really film and games and just, you know, entertainment in general has kind of filled in a lot of that place for inspiration. You know, so many of the technology companies that we meet with and we visit and we talk to, we've literally heard it dozens of times that our work inspires them, that you know, they watch these movies, they get ideas, they look up to it.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Jeremy, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It is my pleasure to have you here. So you wrote in and told me a bit about your story. And when I read the phrase, you know, doing title sequences for Marvel movies, I was like, hell yes, because I think we were in the middle of actually going through the Marvel series. My roommates and I, when I think we got your guest pitch, and I was like, I told my roommates, like, hell yes, you should talk to this guy. And I was like, yeah, I think so too. But before we get into all of that, I wanted to start by asking, what did your parents do for work? And how did that end up shaping and influencing the choices that you made throughout your life and your career?
Oh, well, it's a great question. So I grew up in Brooklyn, in Coney Island. And my parents are both very, very creative. They both went to art school. They met actually at Pratt, which is a great art school in Brooklyn. And my father was a high school art teacher in Coney Island for about 40 years. He taught art, which included drawing and painting and every manner of studio art for high schoolers. My mom, she dabbled in interior design. She dabbled in some fashion stuff. She was also a great calligrapher. So growing up, she would always take these little freelance gigs doing calligraphy for invitations for different, you know, weddings or bar mitzvahs or whatever. So that actually gave me a great love of typography from a young age. But it was my dad who used to let me sort of tag along to sit in on his classes. You know, he would take his high schoolers on field trips to like the Bronx Zoo or Central Park and just to draw. And I would often go with him and his students to do that. He also taught a Saturday morning workshop at the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan in the early 80s that I used to go to as well. It was for high schoolers, but I was, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. And I would sit in on his drawing classes. And I was just exposed to much more advanced, you know, drawing techniques like perspective and drawing figures at a very young age. So it really it really shaped my love of art. And I was always like the class artist in school. But there was an interesting thing at the Saturday morning workshop that he did. There was another class right next door to his that was teaching animation. And, you know, back in the early 80s, animation meant light tables and, you know, drawing one frame at a time on frames and cells. And I actually sat in on that class just as much as my father's. And it led me to draw some animated cartoons at a very young age. And I just have stacks and stacks of these drawings, you know, kind of frame by frame drawings of these cartoon characters that I created. I filmed some of them, my dad, back then, but I still have a lot that were kind of just never filmed and put into motion. But that was a really interesting, I guess, pivotal moment for me, because it opened up my eyes to, you know, movies and moving pictures and flip books and how to bring characters to life. I also loved comic books growing up. I was a fanatic about Marvel Comics. Growing up in the late 70s, the best show on TV, and I'd argue the best show of all time, was The Incredible Hulk with Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno's live action interpretation of the Hulk on every Friday nights. And I just was obsessed with that show. And it was probably my gateway drug into Marvel Comics, because I then started collecting everything Hulk related. And of course, that was the comic. And then it was Hulk magazines and Hulk posters and all kinds of Hulk memorabilia. And then that led me into collecting a lot of other characters within the Marvel universe. So all these things were kind of part of my early childhood, and obviously definitely shaped who I became later on in life.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot maybe your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah. You know, you're one of the rare people here who I think happens to have grown up with creative parents. And I wonder, with parents like the ones you had, what is the narrative about careers, particularly creative careers? Because I think for so many people that have been guests on this show, they're basically the rebel or the black sheep of the family who decided mm-hmm. to go do something creative when they're surrounded by non-creatives. And that's me. Mm-hmm. Like I always jokingly say, I'm, you know, God made a sorting error by giving me to my family.
Well, I think the influence that my father had as an art teacher was to not be an art teacher in a way. You know, he almost dissuaded me from pursuing that. He loved it. He was very passionate about it. He was great at it. But he also always wished that he accomplished more. And, you know, I used to tell him how proud I was of him and everything that he'd done. But, you know, he never was a great financial success, and he never had any commercial success as an artist. And I always, you know, sensed this regret from him. You know, we talked about it a lot, you know, as I was growing up. So, you know, when I was a kid and computers weren't a thing at all back then, you know, it wasn't even, you know, part of the conversation. This is, again, 35 years ago. As a lover of drawing and art, I, you know, was always asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? And, you know, I said, I want to draw. I want to do something with art. And most people would tell me, well, you either become an art teacher or you become an architect. And I definitely didn't want to be an art teacher. Like I said, I kind of watched my father, you know, throughout my life, wish that he had tried to do something more than that. So that sort of led me into this path of pursuing architecture as a career. And that then led me to, when I was applying to colleges, apply to colleges that specialized in architecture. Now, throughout my high school years, I got very much involved in computers. Computers were finally, you know, a thing. And I got my first Mac at 13. I used all my bar mitzvah money to buy a Macintosh Plus in 1986 against my parents' wishes, who wanted me to save the money for college. I put it all on this Mac and this, you know, dot matrix printer. And I said, I want to learn, you know, Mac Paint and Mac Draw and PageMaker and all these desktop publishing programs that no one's probably heard of today, but were very much a thing back then. And I loved it. I was so immersed in it. I loved doing everything on that computer and every, you know, school paper I did on that computer. And I started doing flyers for the school, high school and junior high school. And then I started doing like a school magazine in high school on the computer and really got into, you know, layout and type and really graphic design throughout my high school years. However, you know, I still had this, you know, path that was kind of set for me early on of architecture. So I, you know, I never really veered from that path and it guided me to apply to, you know, some of the best architecture schools in the country, like Cornell and Carnegie Mellon and Rice and several others. And I was accepted at all of them. And I ended up going to Carnegie Mellon. They just gave me an unbelievable scholarship that I pretty much couldn't refuse. But when I got there, as an architecture student, and anyone who knows about architecture schools or who studied architecture knows just how intense it really is. It's always a 5-year program. it's the kind of place where if you're not 100%, you don't belong there. It's 100% or nothing. Like you have to be that committed. You're living in your studio. You're at your desk, you know, 24/7 or in the shop. Mm-hmm. It's really, really, really intense. And I recognized from pretty much week one of architecture school that there was still a lot of uncertainty and doubt I had about making this my life. And as the weeks went on in that first year of my freshman year, I just was really filled with doubt. And I started to question my choices. And as fortunately, Carnegie Mellon also had an amazing graphic design program. And I started considering that maybe that was the more appropriate place for me. And I eventually decided I am going to make the switch. I am going to try to transfer into the graphic design program. So I actually had to reapply to that college of fine arts graphic design program. I had to, you know, submit a portfolio, do an application, do the interviews, the whole thing. And then I was accepted, but I was accepted as a first year student, as a freshman. So I spent my first year of Carnegie Mellon as an architecture student. I finished it out, but I also piled on a ton of electives in other areas like business classes and history and psychology and things like that, art history. But I came back in my second year as a freshman again in a classroom filled with recent high school graduates. And here I am my second year in college. And that's how I started graphic design. So it was always a very strange identity that I had while I was there, because I never quite belonged to one class. Like I still had a lot of friends from architecture school who were sophomores at the time, but now I'm making new friends that are freshmen that are dealing with all the issues of first year college students dealing with being away from home and, you know, adjusting to that whole thing. Stuff that I had kind of gone through already and was done with it. So I kind of was bouncing between these two years my whole time at Carnegie Mellon. The other thing about it was they wanted me to do the full 4 years. So I would have been there 5 years, first year being architecture school, and then the next four being graphic design. But I was able to lobby the staff to allow me to complete it in 3 years. I basically did a whole presentation to the faculty where I put a grid up of all of the requirements needed for graduation. And then I put all of these tiles of all the classes that I would have. And I gradually filled in the entire grid, showing them that I can, in fact, satisfy all that was necessary to graduate in the next 3 years. And I was able to do it. So I kind of had this claim to fame that I was like the first student there to finish the graphic design program in 3 years. Then in my third year there as a junior, you do an independent study. And I was able to study with a professor who had a love of film titles. And I had no idea what film titles were. I never really gave it a second thought. Film title sequences weren't like a thing back then. You know, it wasn't something that was in the vernacular as it is now. Everybody's very well aware of film title sequences. But, you know, in 1993, whenever it wasn't really something you heard of. But I was working with this professor on some animation projects and some what we call kinetic typography projects. And he had this incredible archive of film title sequences that he had been collecting from the greats of the past, like Saul Bass and all the Bond title sequences. And To Kill a Mockingbird is a classic one. All the Hitchcock ones, most of them from Saul Bass. And then he had these were all on videotape back then. And then he had this video of a company in New York called R. Greenberg Associates, which is also RGA for short. And R. Greenberg Associates, he put the tape in, and the first title sequence that showed was Superman from 1978, the first Superman with Christopher Reeve, wow. Marlon Brando, Richard Donner, yeah. Classic, incredible movie. Still one of my all-time favorite superhero films.
Still mine holds too.
Up. Still totally holds up. And anyone who disagrees with me, come at me. But he showed me this tape of R. Greenberg titles, and it was Superman and Alien and Untouchables and all these incredible title sequences from the 80s and 90s. They pretty much did everything. And right then and there, it sort of hit me that, you know, I had this love of film, I had this love of animation, this love of graphic design and typography. And here's a medium that combines all of those things into one really, really specialized focus. And that's exactly what I wanted to pursue. So that was a real, you know, moment of insight for me and definitely led me post-graduation to where I ended up, where I wanted to go.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I wonder, you had the awareness at the end of freshman year to realized that you didn't, you know, want to be an architect. And I know the experience firsthand because I had a roommate who was an architecture major. And I remember once we were throwing around a tennis ball in the bedroom after he had finished this very complicated model. And he looked at me and another friend. And he said, if anything happens to that thing, you should know I'm going to murder both of you. And we both looked at him and was like, you know what? I'm not, I know he's not joking because I know how much time went into this. I was like, stop throwing the fucking tennis ball around now.
Yeah.
I mean, he would literally go and spend the entire night in a studio and come back the next morning.
Yeah. And you know, I think, a lot of the schools that are out there, they actually kind of allow for this attrition. You know, the freshman class is always like 5 times bigger than the senior class, like in terms of seats. So, you know, as a freshman architecture student, there were like 100 kids there.
Yeah.
And by the fifth year, I think there's 20 or 30. Like, that's it. So they, you know, they know that every year they're going to shed, whether it's by choice, but because someone like myself decided, I don't think I want to pursue this. Or as I had heard, you know, certain students were asked to leave.
Yeah,
you know, as part of the, you know, process. And I guess that's just kind of built into the cake. And, you know, it's part of making sure that you're really committed to it. And this is really what you want. I mean, I still have such an incredible respect for architecture, for architects. I love it. I love looking at it. I love, you know, reading about it. I love going to see, you know, great examples of architecture in the world. So that's always going to be with me. But it just wasn't for me, you know, as a career.
Why do you think that, you know, so many people don't have the awareness to realize that until way later in life, until they've basically done something like been an architect for 20 years, only to wake up one day and realize they hate being an architect, whereas you were smart enough to recognize that as a freshman?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, there were just a lot of things that I was looking around at the time, and you know, it was. You know, talking to me and like killing my inner monologue, you know, and all these seeds of doubt that were surrounding me. Like for instance, my professor and several professors were recent grads that couldn't get a job and came back to teach. And I think it was a bad job market back then. I wasn't too honed in on you know, the economy and market cycles as I am now. But back then, you know, seeing like, wow, this guy's like a couple years older than me and he's teaching because he couldn't get a job. That's not a great sign. That's really not what I want to see, you know? And the other thing that I realized later in life is how much of, you know, you have all of these classmates who seem to have everything together, who seem to know exactly what they want, who seem so sure of themselves. And you realize later they were all full of it, you know, they really were. And like, but that created more doubt with me. Like, wow, why am I not like this? My neighbor to the left or to the right, you know, what's wrong with me? Like they're so sure of it. They're so committed to this, must be me, you know? But then you realize, you know, as time goes on and then, wow, that guy like 3 years ago, he transferred out. He's not even there anymore. Or, you know, when you follow your alumni news and you realize that, you know, so-and-so was in your architecture class and is now doing something that has nothing to do with architecture. Yeah. And it's like, you get kind of, all these signs, you know, that if you start listening to them, they really speak very loudly.
You know, one thing I wonder is what influence this has had, on you as a parent and, you know, I'm not sure how old your kids are, but how you think about, you know, both education and career advice for your own children based on the experience you had.
You know, it's something I'm figuring out as we go as well. My kids are pretty young, 10 and 12. But you know, it's a constant, question I have is like, where do you think they're going to end up? What do you think they're going to be doing? I'm just trying, you know, as best I can to support things they enjoy doing and support their hobbies and, you know, see if there's some natural abilities and talents there that I can help, you know, foster along. You know, I'm definitely always trying to draw with both kids to see if there's a genetic factor there. I mean, that was a thing as a kid of an artist and an art teacher. My dad was an incredible artist. Like he painted and drew, and his stuff is, I have actually a website of all of his paintings that I got. He passed away 4 years ago. And, I put a website up of all his watercolor paintings that he did later in life, of a lot of them done in Coney Island of people on the beach. But you know, everybody used to tell me as a kid, like my grade school teachers, cause I was always the kid in the class that was drawing the posters and everything for the classroom. And everybody would say, it's genetic. You got it from your father, you know? And I never really knew if that's true or not. I don't think anybody could be sure of that stuff. You know, for me, it was always just the genetic part was just having the passion and the desire to want to do something really well and putting the time in and the effort and the 10,000 hours or whatever into becoming good at something. So I'm always trying to like put a pencil or a crayon in my kid's hand, like, let's draw. I'll set up a bowl of fruit. Let's draw a still life or whatever. You know, sometimes it goes well, sometimes not so well, but I can't really force it. It just sort of has to happen naturally. Yeah. But I'm not sure at this point where, you know, what career path either one of them are going to take. I mean, they both have told me a lot of different things depending on the day.
And, yeah, it sounds like a 10 and 12 year old.
You know, a couple of years ago, my son wanted to be a WWE wrestler. You know, it, who knows?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to be Superman at one point and an airline pilot at another. So
exactly.
One last thing before we actually start getting into, you know, the Marvel piece and title sequences and that creative process. Just from everything you've said so far, it seems like your father had a really profound influence on your life. And I wonder, what was one of the most important things that he taught you about life or careers, whether it be in the arts or just in general?
I think it's going to go back to living with regret. And not taking the risks that he wishes he took. You know, I think that's something that played a big part for me in starting my own business, because I know that's something that he always talked about. And he actually used to tell me that I should take some business classes, that I might want to start something of my own one day. This was in like high school and then eventually when I got to college. So, you know, I think he definitely had an influence with that. You know, just seeing that he always aspired to do more than just being the teacher that he was and being more successful, you know, having the things that other people had that he never really got. And he always kind of felt a little bit inferior from that stuff. I mean, it's ridiculous for me to say this, but it definitely was something that, you know, I heard a lot of growing up. So I think all those things just play a role, whether it's subconsciously or directly. You know, I definitely think that helped to kind of push and pull me in certain directions.
Yeah. You know, you started a creative career that predates sort of the internet, social media. And I wonder what you've seen change, not in terms of technology and what we're capable of, but in terms of the work ethic of artists, because I feel like there's a sort of shortcut to attention that makes people believe that the work is not necessary.
Just as far as the creative process.
Yeah. I mean, particularly because of social media, right? Like you can sort of shortcut your way to this idea and confuse attention with accomplishment.
Well, you know, just as far as process goes, for me, it's always about pencil and paper. And you know, there's definitely a lot of shortcuts that you can take just by jumping on a computer. Using filters, using, you know, stuff you find on Google, and just starting to put something together, you know, really fast and without too much thought. You know, it was always part of my process to not even go near a computer until you have the idea, you know, kind of fully sketched out, fully framed out. I also used to love going to bookstores when they existed in the big cities. You know, we used to have Barnes and Nobles on every corner. And when we started Perception, my business partner and I, the first thing we'd do when we got a pitch or a project is we'd go to the Barnes and Noble like a block away, get just dozens of books, just stack them up and sit on the floor and just go through books and sketch and just to get inspiration and ideas from the real world. In college, for me, it was always the library. There was an amazing library at Carnegie Mellon. And I would go there. That would be like the first stop after you got a project assignment. Go to the library, spend a whole afternoon there researching, Xeroxing things out of books. You know, we didn't have iPhones to take pictures or anything like that. It was just Xeroxing, taking notes. So it was just a lot about doing things by hand and doing things away from the computer that, you know, I can't say is completely gone, but I definitely don't, you know, see as much of it as I used to, you know, when I was doing it. So I think that's definitely a big change with technology. I mean, now the stuff that you can do with apps and filters, it's just mind blowing. You know, stuff that is almost automated. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable to me. Yeah. You know, the stuff that would take us hours or days to accomplish, you know, an app will do for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember, I think it used to take about 100 hours to build a really basic website when I was in college, and that wasn't that long ago. And now you can build it in 10 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of that stuff is awesome. It's like the Shopify stuff, just put a merchant, a site up in an afternoon. Mm-hmm. It's great.
Yeah. Dude, I think I'm not surprised that you mentioned the role of analog, because there's this really great story you may have read Gar Reynolds' book Presentation Zen, which is all about slide design. And I've mentioned this before, but there's this great section where he talks, he writes about, working at Apple. I think he was on the product evangelist team, and he said he walks into a designer's office and he had a MacBook on it, or iMac on his desk that hadn't been turned on in weeks. He went there thinking they were going to have a presentation, and the guy just handed him a bunch of pieces of paper. And that's when he realized that even to do slide design, he never does anything on a computer until exactly what you're talking about, until he's sketched everything out. And I've noticed even as a writer, when you write by hand, it fundamentally changes the way you write. Like, it, one, you're forced to be much more concise with your language. You're also much more thoughtful because you can't just fly through whatever you're writing. So I remember I basically did this exercise. I was like, let me rewrite this article. And I thought, wait a minute, I just said in one sentence, when I wrote by hand, what did I was able, I said by three when I wrote on a computer.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think that you, when you're on a computer, there's also so much temptation to bounce around and look at other things, you know, and when you're just hunched over a pad or pieces of paper or books, like that's it. That's nothing else you could possibly divert your attention to. Whereas you're on a computer, oh, I got this window open and this person is chatting me and you know what I mean? You got an email popping up. There's just too much. There's too much there, and the level of focus is totally different.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the creative process of these title sequences, because I mean the Marvel title sequences are insane. I mean, I've seen them. They're a whole other level of title sequence compared to what you see in. Yeah, they really are. So what actually goes into them? Because they're almost every one of them is unforgettable. Every time I see them, I'm like, yeah, if I had a conference, this is how I would start it.
Yeah. There's a lot that goes into them. First of all, I should just start out by saying, you know, it's a dream come true that that we've gotten to work on so many of them. The first one we did ever was Avengers Age of Ultron. That was the first film title sequence. But go back earlier than that, and we actually, our very first opportunity to work on a Marvel title sequence came with their animated DVDs. They used to release these, you know, feature length animated films on DVD, and they had title sequences with those. And we did three of them, Hulk versus Wolverine, Tales of Asgard, and Planet Hulk. They might all be on Disney Plus, I'm not sure, but those are kind of our audition for Marvel. We did those. They predate anything else that we've done. And we had very little time to do them and very little budget, but we took them so, so seriously, and we put our heart and souls into them, and they all came out really, really well. But just speaking in general, when we're doing a title sequence, you know, first and foremost is hopefully we get to see some version of the film, in some form, some edit of it. Sometimes it's in a more, finished form, and sometimes it's in a very, very rough form. But it's all about watching the film and really getting into the story and really understanding all the story beats and all of the characters. All the important moments in the film, because a lot of times the title sequences that we do need to echo those exact story beats or those moments that we just saw in the film. We want to either honor in the title sequence or kind of echo them in some clever way. We also do a lot of stuff, by storyboard. We'll actually map out a title sequence with, pencil and paper. And just literally like plot it out as almost like a comic book with different panels showing the different moments of the sequence. You know, a lot of things that we do too is create like more than we actually need. So let's say there's 35 different title cards in a sequence, you know, 35 different credits, give or take. We might come up with 50 vignettes, 50 moments, 50, you know, title sequence moments that we think are clever or memorable, or we'll have some kind of interesting visual impact, and we'll sort of put all those in front of the Marvel team and then kind of pick out our favorites, pick out the ones that sort of match the name that it's going with, right? You know, certain of these story beats and these vignettes actually go really well with the director or with the cinematographer or with the lead actor or actress, writer, what have you. So that's a big part of the process, is kind of figuring out, you know, what that mix and match looks like. Another really important thing is the music. Music is, the emotion behind it all, the driving force A lot of times directors will have a track. I think, you know, with Spider-Man Homecoming, one of my favorites, we got the track before we even started designing anything. So we knew it was going to that music. So we wanted to design to that with that in mind. You know, Black Panther, we found out kind of early in the process about the Kendrick Lamar track. But once we did, we had a, you know, blast just refining everything to work really well with that music. Then other times they don't have a track in mind and we might even propose a track. So take Black Widow, for example, which is an opening title, one of the very few that are in any of the MCU movies. And we actually suggested the temp track, Smells Like Teen Spirit, that really interesting cover of it. And they ultimately loved it. And once they saw, you know, all the work in progress with that music so many times, it kind of became married to it. It's like, all right, well, we got to get this track. And they got the rights and the license to use it. And that's what's in the movie. So that track is something that our team proposed. And it went really, you know, went over really well. Yeah, there's just, you know, every one of these has a little bit of a different process. Some we have a little bit more time to accomplish than others. Some is a complete fire drill. You know, we have to really get this done really quick. Others, we have more time to tweak it. Some are more three-dimensionally heavy. Others are more two-dimensional. Some are more handmade. Like, again, Homecoming had a lot of stuff where we built things by hand, whether it was the magic marker or the clay or all the little sketchy pops that we made throughout it. And then something like Avengers Age of Ultron was a complete photoreal 3D extravaganza of a sculpture of the, you know, the Avengers, world's greatest heroes. So, you know, there's a lot of different things that go into each of these creative solutions. So no two are quite the same.
Yeah. What combination of skill sets are involved in this? I'd imagine that it's not just you and one partner doing all this, right?
No, not at all. It's an amazing team. It's an amazing team.
You guys, like Ocean's 11 of... Are you basically like an Ocean's 11 type team of people who all do, you know, various things really well?
I think so. Yeah. I think, you know, everybody has an amazing, you know, set of skills. And then like, as a team, it's like unstoppable. Everybody brings something unique, to the group. And then together they kind of amplify each other's skills. Yeah. But I, you know, occasionally we do have to bring in some very specific skill sets to help amplify what we have, because there's something specific or unique in what we're trying to accomplish, that we might not possess ourselves. So we'll bring in help as necessary. Mm. But at our core, you know, we're an incredibly talented group.
Yeah. How do you figure out things like typography and visuals and select? I mean, is it just a constant testing? Is it basically multiple iterations of what, you know, before what, you know, we end up seeing on the screen? Because now I actually want to go back and see all these title sequences after our conversation.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of iterations. Yeah, there's definitely, you know, there's a lot of iterations involved. There's a lot of trial and error. There's a lot of put a bunch of different looks in front of the Marvel team and get a reaction from them. You know, what they usually say is give us a wedge. That's their term. Give us a wedge of type choices. So we'll, you know, we'll take a title card and then set it like 20 different ways and see what they react best to, what's most legible, what works well within the composition, of the frame, maybe something that has, something unique or special about it. That's, appropriate to the movie and to the tone that we're trying to do. So yeah, that all goes into it.
One thing, this is a weird question, but, how does typography impact, emotion, like the emotion that I feel when I'm seeing a title screen?
I guess it's just the way it's set, the choice of typography that is made, making sure that, again, it's just sort of evoking the right tone. Is it quiet? Is it loud? Is it romantic? Is it classic? You know, is it cold? Is it warm? You know, all of these types of feelings and moods can be evoked from the right selection of typography. You know, and figuring out the right balance, of the letters to whatever else is on the screen, you know, to go along with it, and making sure that everything is is complementing each other, and one isn't distracting from the other. You know, sometimes the typography is really, really well integrated into whatever the scene is, like it's literally a part of the scene. So it might have some depth or dimension because it's mapped onto a surface. And then other times it's very clearly in front of everything else. You know, it's just sort of sits in a plane all unto itself. You know, so all these things go into the creative choices that are made.
Yeah. How do you keep staying innovative when you've, you know, done one superhero movie after another, you know, without sort of, I mean, obviously you have different characters, but still I'd imagine that that's got to be a challenge.
Oh yeah. It's always a challenge. You know, it's always the fun part of it too, is trying to figure out what's unique about this film that we can really play off of. Is there an idea here that hasn't been done before that we can really try to explore? And, you know, I like to say, get ourselves into a little bit of trouble with, you know, make ourselves sweat a little bit, try something new technically, try something new creatively that then we have to figure out. Because it's in those types of projects and those types of moments that we grow and we learn. You know, we never want to keep doing the same thing over and over again, because you just get stale, kind of plateau. So we're always looking to push the boundaries. And it's really easy with Marvel because they're doing the same thing with their films. I mean, every one of their films is ups the ante so much, whether, you know, it's with the visual effects, the scenes that they're doing, the action sequences, the powers of these characters. It's always, it consistently just keeps going higher and higher. So, you know, for us, it's kind of just complementing that and playing off of that and making sure that we're doing all that justice.
Yeah. How do other people bring that into their own creative process? Because one common thing that I have found when I've talked to, you know, readers of our newsletter and, you know, through survey data is a sort of lack of creative confidence. People are so afraid of, it's funny because they think it's fear of failing, but it, you know, fear of failing turns into fear of trying at all. And of course,
right,
nobody wants to admit that, by the way, the first time you do anything, it's going to suck.
Yeah. Sorry, what was the question?
How do other people bring that sense of creative confidence to push the boundaries the way you're talking about into their own work?
That's a good question. I think you just gotta keep trying new things, and you know, if you have the ambition to want to be great and to want to continue to grow, then it really should be a natural thing. You should want to continue to try to challenge yourself. You know, we have a saying at Perception, be comfortable being uncomfortable. You know, and that is to say that we want you to keep pushing your own limits. We want you to keep pushing what the limits of what you think you can do and what you know how to do, because it's when you challenge yourself that you learn and you develop as a designer and as a creative. You know, as a company, we grow with you. Like, that's the whole reason we've been around 20 years, is that the team continues to grow and the team continues to expand and in their abilities and what they can do. And that just makes the whole company advance together.
Yeah.
So
what has been your personal favorite of all the title sequences that you've done? Or is that like asking you to choose which of your children is your favorite?
Yeah. I think, you know, they all definitely have something, you know, special about them. They all have something unique, and there's you know, I also associate each one with like a moment in my life. Mm. And that for some of those moments, they just really stand out. So, you know, right off the bat, Avengers Age of Ultron for me was a highlight, because it was the first one we've ever done. And that sort of was a dream come true. It took, I don't know, 7-8 years of trying to get Marvel's attention. Like, I didn't even tell you how we started working with Marvel. That's a whole other thing.
Yeah, actually, I'd love to hear that if you have the time.
So yeah. So rewind. We started Perception in 2001, so that's 20 years ago. And I mentioned early in the conversation how much I love Marvel. Growing up, I was a Hulk fanatic and Marvel Comics fanatic. And in 2001, we started Perception. We broke away. My first job was at R. Greenberg, RGA, the company I mentioned earlier that did Superman. I ended up working for them. I worked for them for 5.5 years, met my business partner, Danny Gonzalez, who we founded Perception together. And when we founded it, you know, one of the early goals was to get back into film titles that I had been working on at RGA. But if you look at the Marvel cinematic timeline, you realize that 2000 was the first big, real serious Marvel movie. It was X-Men, came out in 2000. I mean, you can go back to Blade in the late 90s, also a good movie. But X-Men was the first time that, you know, we saw really, you know, incredible actors, Patrick Stewart, Hugh Jackman, Bryan Singer directed it. Like, this is the Marvel movie that Marvel fans were craving, you know, their whole lives. And then in 02 was the first Spider-Man movie with Tobey Maguire, and Spider-Man 2 and X-Men 2 were in pre-production. But the other movie that was in pre-production, right when we were really getting Perception off the ground, was The Hulk. And it was Ang Lee's Hulk with Eric Bana. Now, looking back, it was a horrible movie. I'm not a fan. What they did to my character is heresy. But I didn't know that when I heard that this movie was in pre-production. All I knew is I got to get involved. We got to do the titles for this movie. I mean, not only do I want to do title sequences, but imagine if we could do the title sequence for the Hulk movie. So all of a sudden, like, the fire was lit. I had to figure out, how are we going to get, you know, the attention of this team, of how are we going to get into Marvel? How are we going to, you know, figure out, you know, who to talk to, who's the right, you know, person. So it just basically started a multi-year crusade to figure out how to get the attention of Marvel. And that took us down many paths, a lot of dead ends, many dead ends, a lot of rejections and, you know, unanswered emails and phone calls. But ultimately, it was in 2000, I think it was 2008 or not. Yeah, I think it was 2008. I never go to college alumni events, and I'm sure you get invited to your college alumni events too. But, you know, being in New York, I'd always get these invitations for CMU alumni events. But there was one particular invitation that I got back then where an alumni named Ken West was speaking, and it said, Ken West is the CFO of Marvel. And this is before Marvel was bought by Disney. Marvel was 100 people. All right. I think Iron Man had come out. And that was it. And basically, he was speaking on this particular night at the Carnegie Mellon New York City alumni evening or whatever. So I said, I guess I'm going to this one. So I went to that. I met Ken. We hit it off. We had a great conversation. He came to visit Perception like a couple days later with some of his Marvel colleagues. And then he actually sent an introductory email for me to Kevin Feige, who, of course, is the president of Marvel Studios and, you know, a visionary. And that led to going out to California, having a couple of meetings. We actually showed some ideas for some of the films that they were coming out with just on our own, just put together some sketches because we were so excited about what they were doing, showed them the passion that we had for the characters. And, you know, at the time, all the work that Perception had been doing was for television. We had no film work really to speak of. We had a great portfolio, a growing portfolio of broadcast work for big networks like HBO and ESPN. Did a lot of work with ad agencies doing commercial graphics and animation. But, you know, no film, none. So we got a call when they were shooting Iron Man 2 in 2009. One of the producers on it, a guy, Jeremy Latcham, who we had met in person at one of those earlier meetings, remembered us and remembered, you know, we did some great stuff for television, some great broadcast design, and they needed an animation for Iron Man 2 of the Stark Expo logo. It's the opening scene of the film where Tony lands on stage and he throws off the Iron Man suit and he says, "Welcome to the Stark Expo." And there's a huge screen behind him playing this animation of the Stark Expo. It's a logo sequence. And they asked us, can we create and animate this? They need it in a week. They're actually shooting it on set. It's going to be live, you know, projected behind Robert Downey Jr. And they thought of us because we had a lot of animation and logos on our reel. They thought it was something we could do. Of course, I mean, are you kidding me? I jumped through the phone to say we could do it. And we did it. It went very well. We had a million ideas that we had shown them, you know, when we were first doing our first presentation. It was literally like, you know, the presentation we were waiting our whole lives for. And one of the designs that we had shown they pointed to on this call, and they said, "Wow, that would be a cool design for Tony's glass phone." And we're like, "What? Tony's glass phone? What did it? You know, it's one of those things we weren't really meant to hear that, but we heard it, and it definitely we filed it in the back of our minds. So after we delivered the Stark Expo logo animation, which we did in about a week or two because they needed it that quickly, and Marvel was very thankful and said, you know, we'll call you if we need you. I thought, you know, this can't be it. This can't be it. We've waited all these years to get an opportunity with Marvel, and that's it. And we just decided we got to do something to keep them coming back. So we decided to take the design they mentioned would be cool for his glass phone, and we actually built a glass phone animation, which you could see on our website. And just in a weekend, we bought a piece of plexiglass at Home Depot, put together this motion test of what his phone could be, sent it off on a Monday. And I said to the team, get ready. Marvel's going to call us back as soon as I hit send on this email, and we'll be off to the races. And I hit send on the email with this incredible motion test. And the phone never rang, and I never got a response. And days turned into weeks, weeks turned into months. And I was very dejected, and all hope had been lost. And then one morning I woke up with an email from the producer with some secret access code to look at some footage and look at some scenes in the movie that they wanted us to bid on to put a quote together to do. And within those scenes was actually the scenes of Tony's phone. They really loved the test. It just took them a long time to get to it. They're very busy, obviously. So what that then led to was over 120 shots in Iron Man 2, which was not the titles, actually. We did a lot of the tech work of Tony Stark. So it was his phone, his smart mirror, he had a coffee table that he looks up Black Widow on. He had, you know, windows throughout his house that were projecting television feeds. So we really did a lot of the technology and the gadgetry. We did a lot of work on the holograms too for Jarvis around Tony Stark. And, it was an amazing project. It changed our lives in so many ways. You know, it really opened up the relationship with Marvel Studios that we maintain to this day. But the other incredible thing that happened after that movie was the technology world came calling. So we did all this work thinking this is just another design challenge. How do we solve a phone graphics for Tony Stark? And then a week later, Microsoft is calling us saying they love our interface design. They love our cinematic use of user experience design. Would we be interested in collaborating on a real piece of technology? And one by one, we started getting opportunities in the tech world. So over, several months and years of that happening, we really refocused and cemented our position and our story as designing for both film and technology, science fiction and science fact. And it's this really awesome yin and yang where they both feed so well into each other. You know, the more we work on real tech projects with real tech clients, the more we're able to inform the technology that we design in Marvel movies, whether it's Tony Stark or the tech that we design for Wakanda or the tech that we do for Black Widow or Spider-Man or so many other films that we design technology for. And then the tech companies that we work with love that we're working on the movies because they want the team that's conceptualizing the future tech for Wakanda and Tony Stark to bring that thinking and that vision into their product, their real world application, and their next gen user experience design. So it's become a really unique story that we've carved out for ourselves.
Yeah, there's so many random questions come to us. One, this is just like a bizarre, morbid curiosity question. So have you tried to set up your own house like Tony Stark? I mean, I would if I had these skill sets. I'd be like, I wonder if I could replicate this in my own house.
Yeah, no, it's It was an amazing learning experience for us. And one of the funny things is that a lot of tech clients for a long time after that said they were coming to Perception because they wanted something that felt Tony Stark, they wanted something that felt Iron Man, and we kind of got what that meant. We sort of became like the brand ambassadors for Stark Tech, if you will, But, you know, what works in movies doesn't necessarily work in real life. And, you know, even if you had this tech, it would be pretty exhausting to be, you know, moving your arms around in the air all day.
Yeah.
You know, it looks really cool when Robert Downey's doing it and he's, you know, incredible actor. And the way that we design those holograms is very artistic, very impressionistic. They wanted it to feel, you know, like it was his imagination unleashed, that he's the modern day digital Da Vinci. So, you know, we created all that. But yeah, it's not really practical.
How far off are we from any of this stuff being like practical application in the real world?
You know, a lot of the stuff that we got to do in that movie has already come to fruition. The smart mirror, you know, there's plenty of mirrors now for the health and fitness market and other applications that we're all too familiar with. Same thing with the smart table that he was using. You know, the holograms, I've seen a lot of different companies attempt to do some holographic stuff. Of course, nothing quite looks the same as Jarvis.
Yeah.
But just, you know, I'm talking to you through these AirPods and I'm thinking about the Avengers when they all have like something in their ear that they're communicating with each other on.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I got an Oculus
back then.
What's Oculus that? Recently. I got an Oculus headset about 2 months back and I'm blown away by what's possible inside of it.
Wow. Yeah, haven't gotten one yet, but I'm excited to try it out.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. There's the possibilities are endless because you're no longer constrained by the limitations of physical reality.
Yeah. Well, you know, the age-old story of science fiction inspiring science fact, you know, that used to be so true with books, you know, inspiring inventors, whether it was 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by Jules Verne, inspiring, you know, the submarine, and H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, inspiring the inventor of the rocket ship, you know, now is really film and games and just, you know, entertainment in general has kind of filled in a lot of that place for inspiration. You know, so many of the technology companies that we meet with and we visit and we talk to, we've literally heard it dozens of times that our work inspires them. That you know, they watch these movies, they get ideas, they look up to it. You know, it's yeah. Really it's fascinating. So,
well, two final questions for you. I mean, it sounds like you had quite a long journey to getting to this point. In that time, you know, while you're waiting for Marvel to, you know, reply to these emails and show up, do you ever feel like you wanted to give up?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, that's all. It depends on the day. You know, some days you do, and some days you kind of recharge and you go back at it. I think it's natural. You know, but I never, you know, obviously never did. So those thoughts are quickly cast aside. I take another angle at it, or I try another direction, or, you know, there's always something else you can do. And you know, you can't ever say I tried everything. You know, at least I haven't felt that way. I always felt like there's more that can be done, or there's something else you can try, or some clever approach. Like I said, we had even created some materials on our own to show them that they didn't ask us to see, just because, you know, coming from the world of advertising and broadcast design, a lot of times, when we were pitching stuff, we had to sort of like bring stuff that they weren't even expecting to see to get the job. Like you just had to go to another level to show a client that you know their brand and you understand their brand and like you're living and breathing their brand. And those are oftentimes the design studios that get awarded projects because they just show that level of commitment and immersion in what they're presenting. So, you know, we did that a lot with Marvel too.
Yeah. Wow. Well, this has been amazing. I have one final question for you, which I know you've probably
that
heard me
quick.
Ask before. Yeah, it really did. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think, you know, it's really when someone's work or is just unique and special. It's one of a kind. It's recognizable. You know, where there's no question who did it. It's definitely, you know, this person or this team that definitely becomes unmistakably theirs. I also think, you know, something that we strive to do as we matured as a business, and, you know, believe me, I made every mistake in the book and I learned a lot of this stuff the hard way, is part of, you know, of achieving a level of success as a design studio is figuring out, you know, what makes you unique and what makes you special and what makes you different than the thousands of other talented design studios out there. And part of that is figuring out what you're an expert in and what can be your special niche that no one else can claim. And, you know, for us, it took a very long time and it happened organically. My partner Danny, like, wake up one day and at the beginning and say, all right, we're going to design for Marvel movies and technology companies. You know, that just sort of happened. And then once it happened, we saw it, we recognized it, we fine tuned the story, we figured out what is the best way to tell that story. And then we continue to refine it, you know, constantly. We're always trying different ways or better ways to present that and tell that story. But it was very important to figure out what makes you unmistakable, what makes you special, and what makes you stand apart.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story, your wisdom, and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you? I mean, obviously they can go watch a bunch of Marvel movies, but where can they find out specifically about you and your work?
Experienceperception.com is the website. We have a YouTube channel. We have Instagram. We're on Twitter, Facebook, all the social platforms. And look forward to hearing from you out there.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.